Welcome to Bina, KALW's program featuring creative voices from the Jewish Community Center of San Francisco. In this series, we bring you remarkable artists and thinkers who've come to speak at the JCCSF as part of our Arts and Ideas program. On this edition of Bina, our guest is Flea, bassist and co-founder of the Red Hot Chili Peppers. He's joined in conversation by music journalist and author Joel Selvin. And now, join Darrell Andrew Packard on stage at the JCCSF as he introduces Flea and Joel Selvin.
If you're like me, the Red Hot Chili Peppers served up the soundtrack of your life. Regardless of your own personal memories, the music of Flea and the Red Hot Chili Peppers has left an indelible impression on all of us. Their contribution to music has spanned generations, cultural boundaries, and continents, and it brought us all here this evening to relish in this unique moment together. Shabbat is the Jewish day of rest, a day to heal and reflect. As he describes in his new memoir, Acid for the Children, Flea's wild ride to leading up to the rise of the Chili Peppers was anything but easy. So who better to encourage us in our own healing and reflection than a musician whose journey has necessitated so much of his own? We are honoring Shabbat tonight by coming together in this moment, in a chaotic world, to acknowledge the things that we make our lives wonderful, to connect with others who share our passions, and to be inspired to go out and create even more joy in the world. In his own poetic wisdom before the song Deep Kick, Flea reminds us, in our face, mortality and lots of things seem futile then, but love and music can save us, and did. Love and music can save us, and did. Appearing on stage with Flea tonight is Joel Selvin, a legend in his own right. He has written 18 best-selling books on rock and roll and contributed over 40 years of award-winning music journalism to the world. Please, welcome to the JCCSF stage, Joel Selvin and Flea.
I just wanted to say, well, thank you for your applause. I'm very grateful to be here with Joel and be with everybody here tonight, and that I just love books, and it means so much to me that everyone came out tonight to talk about books and to celebrate literature that is a part of me that I never get to share, and I'm just really grateful for the opportunity. And literature is a vehicle for me to express a part of myself that I never would have had a chance to express otherwise. And in the time that we're in now, which is a really divisive and strange time in this country, our stories to share with one another, to bring us all together, is one of the, if not the most important thing that we have. In every great culture, great tradition, people hand down stories from one another, and they're crucial. And writing this book, I kind of, you know, at a certain point struggled with, why am I writing about myself? And at a certain point, it dawned on me that absolutely the necessary, the crucial, the important thing for just the book itself. So thank you all for coming and caring and being a part of Something About Literature. Thank you.
So, Flea, you know, I told you backstage that, you know, I help people write these books.
Yeah.
And I always ask them the same thing, and I want to ask you, why would you want to write this book?
I just kind of said, because, but I had been asked many times to write a memoir, and I'd always said no, because it seemed ridiculous to me that here I am, this humble, curious person, well, occasionally humble, occasionally an arrogant maniac, but I'm a work in progress. I'm still learning how to love myself, for crying out loud, let alone write a book about it. But at a certain point, I don't know why, it just made sense, and I said yes, and I started off thinking, well, I'll just write about the Red Hot Chili Peppers, because it would be arrogant and ridiculous for me to write about my personal life or my childhood, and I'll brush over it and get to the band, and, you know, it's interesting, because my relationship to the band, my, you know, the interior part of me, would be different than anything that people have read about. But once I started writing, and I started thinking about my childhood, and all these things were so murky and so like difficult for me to understand, like these signpost events throughout my childhood that really made me who I am. And I just became obsessed with a journey of self-discovery to understand my childhood, to get underneath the things that happened and see why did these events happen? What was the energy underneath that made it move, that made me who I am? And for Chili Pepper fans, that my childhood and everything leading up to it would answer more questions about the band than anything that I could write about the band's existence after it started.
I completely understand. And having read the book, I understand. I mean, this must have been a tough sell to the publishers. And I got to say at this stage, just because we're sitting here in front of people, this book is excellent.
Oh, man. Well, he didn't tell me that backstage. I don't know if he liked it or not. I'm like, oh, he's an experienced, smart writer, and I'm, you know, a Philistine. But thank you. You know, when I didn't tell the publishers that I had only that I ended the book when the band started, I told them that after it was written. And I had made the decision early on. This is just going to be about my childhood, and I kind of was, you know, one of the reasons beyond my own like yearning to understand myself was a reaction against the Rockstar book. You know, I just like Rockstardom itself. Is a pretty banal and boring thing, bordering on pathetic, you know. So, you know, I just wanted to write something different. I wanted to do something that everyone would want. Like, when I started off just wanting to do it, it was kind of out of fear, I realized. I would, like, hide behind the guise of the Red Hot Chili Peppers. And when I started writing, and I started, you know, feeling this deep desire within myself to understand who I am, I realized that the bravest thing I could do and my best chance of actually writing something that could contribute to literature would be just to write about my childhood.
You know? Well, it really is wonderfully laid out as a deep and complex story, but I found myself unable to put it down. I kept thinking I was going to, at any moment now, like, want to go to sleep and, you know, this was going to turn boring. Part of the reason is not just because you did really till up all that dirt and it's all there for us to see on the pages, but your skill with words is just phenomenal.
Well, thank you so much. What's something I didn't know, like I've written little things before, like a little essay here or there, an intro for someone's record or a friend's like, hey, will you write something about my whatever I'm doing? But I love books so much. Like all my life, even when I was like living on the street, crazy, robbing, you know, doing drugs, just up to no good, and could have, you know, on many a slippery slope was I. And any disastrous reality could have befallen me. But one of the things, like my most guiding light, you know, music, but books. Like as soon as I learned to read, I was in love with reading. And for like book every day of my life. I read. Even, you know, when I was a kid, unless I was too wasted to do it, I did it. It's hard to read on a heroin nod, you know?
I know.
But thank you. But when I sat down and started writing, I just fell in love with it.
With
writing. It's just the act of writing, the way the words look next to each other on the page, the colors that they make when you see them next to each other, just the syllables, the words themselves. I loved it. It engaged a part of me that I had never engaged before. You know, like all my life playing music, I've always wanted to get to this place beyond thought, this place where I totally let go and let this divine rhythm course through me. And because I know when I'm at my best, I'm not thinking. I'm just letting things flow, and I'm a vehicle for something way bigger than me. And I'm always yearning to get in that place, but I didn't know that existed in writing. And I would get up in the morning without thinking. I wouldn't drink water. I wouldn't drink coffee. I wouldn't do anything. I'd stumble out of bed. Boom, straight to the pen, write. And I didn't care. I'd write about anything. My shoes, a leaf I saw outside, my dog's anything. I would just write, you know? And every time I put my head up from writing, whether it was stream of conscious nonsense or I actually thought I managed to find some insight into something that might be of use to my story, every time I put my head up, I just felt so, like vibrating with like engaging this part of myself that I had never used before. And it was a new type of creativity, and it just was, man, it was, made me so happy. And then I'd, you know, I read that one of my favorite writers is Toni Morrison, and when I was trying to figure out how I was going to do it, like how to structure my writing, I looked up how she wrote, like about her writing process. And she said she got up in the morning, wrote real free, and then she'd take a few hours off, go back in the afternoon and look at it, because when she wrote free, she didn't think about grammar or anything, she just wrote. And so I kind of made it into two different processes. There was the free writing, and then there was the analytical organization of thoughts. And I just love it, man. Thank you so much for your kind words. And my greatest goal, you know, I had two rules to myself when I wrote this book. One was to be completely honest, you know, not try to make myself look good. And also I had to learn to not self-flagellate as well. But, and the other rule was that I had to write every word myself. You know, I could not let, you know, and...
Well, that's interesting you say that. I noticed that you refer in your acknowledgments to an editor by the name of David Ritz.
Yeah.
I've never known that David was an editor. I've known David for years. He's co-written books with Ray Charles, Marvin Gaye, B.B. King, blah, blah, blah.
He also co-wrote the song Sexual Healing by Marvin Gaye.
Yeah, he had to sue to get the credit.
Yeah, yeah.
But, David's an amazing guy.
He's a...
And he's nobody's editor.
No, well... When the publishers presented David Ritz to me, and I think at first, they were thinking he would be a co-writer, you know, trusting me. I don't know. I'm kind of supposing that right now, thinking about it.
Oh, I'm sure they did,
but,
yeah.
Yeah, so, but he's a ghostwriter and a co-writer and an author in his own right and a great writer. And when I told him that there was no way that anyone was writing anything for me, and actually in the beginning of the book, I had a thing that I was so proud of. It was this thing I wrote about, it was like an insult to all ghostwriters. It was like, there's a great rapper called Young M.A. that I really like, and she had, I can't remember the line, but I started the book with a quote by Young M.A. that said, it was like, I don't use no ghostwriter, that's like driving a whip with no tires. And I can't remember, the line was something like that, and don't forgive my, I'm no rapper. But I'm a fan of Young M.A., and I thought it was a great quote. And then I had this kind of diatribe against it, because as a reader, I'm always confused by ghostwriter books. I'm like, who wrote it? But David straightened me out real quick on that. You know, he said, look, I've written books for people that didn't know that were illiterate.
Yep,
you know,
he sure has.
Yeah, and they wanted to tell their stories, and it's a really valuable thing. And even if someone might not be illiterate, they might not have the tools or the wherewithal to write a book, and their story is really important. And I, you know, I got off my arrogant high horse and saw that he was right. But nonetheless, you know, I told him, you know, how I wanted to function on this book, and he was cool with it. And he was humble, and he bought out a humility in me. And he taught me, he gave me one incredible thing that he did for me. Besides, and this was really where he told me how to write a book. Because I started off and it was this free sprawling, free spirited, stream of consciousness, sprawling, ranting poem. The whole thing, you know, put into like different sections. And it was beautiful in its way. You know what I mean? And he said, he goes, this is beautiful in its way, and it's got a style all its own, and it's got deep feelings in it, and you're expressing, you know, thoughts that are only yours. But it's hard. I can't read this. It's hard to read. And he told me something that two people told me, and he just talked about you got to have rhythm to your writing. People have to be able to groove to your writing in a different way. You're not dancing to it, but your brain has to feel a rhythm when you read. And I thought about all the books that I loved and how much rhythm it had when I started thinking of it in that way. And that really, that was when I found my style of doing it in kind of these clean, short stories that kind of form a tapestry of a narrative. And then he helped me with grammar, and he helped me with, like, look, you're repeating yourself too much here. And then sometimes we got in crazy fights because we sat down. Like, once after I wrote everything, he goes, okay, we're going to go through this together. And I read it all out loud to him. And he'd be, nope, that's no good. You know what I mean? He'd rewrite that. And then every once in a while, he would try to give me a sentence. And it infuriated me. I would yell at him, don't tell me that. And like, it got really contentious because he would give me a sentence that was better than my sentence.
Yeah.
And I couldn't use it.
And
I might have thought of a better sentence on my own, and now he's polluted me with a better sentence. You know, and we got it. It got real contentious, but I was
so
real,
unfair.
Yeah, so cruel, trying to give me good sentences. So, you know, the abuse that I suffer, you know. So, but in any event, he really helped me a lot. And his thing about rhythm, and once he kind of showed me a way, and he was like, look, you, because I would think, like, to describe something, sometimes I do, like, three sentences that said the same thing, but to me, each one described a different facet of the same thing. And he was like, dude, no. You know, one sentence will do it. You know, I learned a lot. And I would repeat myself in, I had such an earnest and yearning desire to really be understood. Like, and it's part of my book and part of my life and part of all of my life. And I think we all have this, you know, it's like as a kid, you want to be loved and you want to be understood. Forgive me, sorry. And all my life has been this deep yearning to be understood. And sometimes, you know, wanting to be understood is wanting to be loved. And you can only ever be loved in an equal proportion to the measure that you love yourself. And so that applied to the writing too. And it's like, you know, all my life playing music and stuff, like part of it is fueled by the most healthy thing in the world. Like I've had these incredible guiding lights of people who do the things that human beings are capable of, their highest level, our great human beings, you know, our Nusrat Fateh Ali Khans, our John Coltranes, our Charlie Parkers, our Jimi Hendrixes, our Bob Dylans, you know, our people who show us the way, you know, who shine the light for us. And all these people have guided me all my life, but also I've been fueled by something that's unhealthy, which is like, please love me, like, let me know I'm okay. Am I an okay human being, you know? Because I didn't really have a family structure or a normal type of love that you have when you're a kid. And I think maybe that's the case with many an artist and many a creative person, yeah, or many a person in every kind of walk of life.
Right.
But anyway, David, when he told me that about the rhythm and writing, it also helped me to kind of sit back and let the groove happen while I was writing, as opposed to forcing and like, here's who I am, you know, and just kind of let go and let my highest self come out on the page. And, you know, my friend Patty, who wrote the intro to this book,
Patty Smith.
Yeah, she told me the same thing, and she was deeply encouraging to me. Like, I knew that I had to write the book by myself. I was scared that I would fail. I knew that I had to be, you know, as earnest and as true and write as poetically and as beautiful as I was capable. And, you know, I thought there was a good chance I might fail and be laughed at, you know, and dismissed. And, you know, that was really scary. And she was from the beginning, you know, before I read a word, and she didn't know if I could write anything. She was like, Flea, I know you. You can do this. Like, you have the insight. You have the feeling. You have it inside you. And halfway through, I gave her the pages. She's like, you're a natural. You can do this. I gave her the pages. I'm so proud of you, Flea. Let me write a forward. You know, like, that type of encouragement from someone that I admire so much.
Not a bad writer herself.
She's one of she's a national treasure, you know. Really, you know, the encouragement of the people who I respect and love during the process was, you know, remarkable.
Yeah. Was there really a 1,200-page manuscript?
Well, I filled up a lot of journals, you know. And I originally wrote my sprawling, crazy poem, which happened when I busted my arm up real bad, and I was, you know, I had all these plates put in it, and I was stuck on the couch for a few months, and that's when I wrote all of that. And then when I decided to just write about my childhood, then I just took the part, you know, up to there and started refining it and organizing it and finding my rhythm as I was taught.
Yeah. I want to read just a little bit, and I picked out the part where you talked about listening to rock records for the first time.
Ooh,
it's just this is a guy writing his first book. What a facility for language! Hillel and I spent hours and hours listening to his rock records: Hendrix, the mighty Led Zepp, Rush, Jeff Beck, The Doors. I was such a jazz geek; it was all new to me. I felt the Hendrix deep inside my little heart. Lying on his living room floor, I fell in love with rock music, listening to Houses of the Holy and leafing through his mom's M.C. Escher book, the rhythms morphing in and out of each other. I imagined them throwing me around like a ferocious wave, contorting me into new shapes and giving me wings. I started looking at music in a new way, seeing color and attitude instead of notes and scales. Hillel's rock star dreams beamed around the room. They were infectious, his yearning hitting me in the chest. I mean, that's just a... Yeah, really. And folks, I'm telling you, that's not like even the best writing in the book at all. That's a very just ordinary piece of prose out of this book.
You're listening to bassist and co-founder of the Red Hot Chili Peppers, Flea, whose new memoir is Acid for the Children. He's joined in conversation by music journalist and author Joel Selvin on Bina, a series featuring creative voices from the Jewish Community Center of San Francisco. Bina is also available as a podcast, and you can find it at kalw.org.
Your facility for language is extraordinary. Your insights are just extraordinarily wonderful. You poke at things and you make fun of things and you reveal yourself in surprising and profound ways. And it's just, in the end, we know you and your life in really wonderful. Tell me, okay, these people, finish me up on a couple of things. Where's Walter? What happened with Walter?
Well, Walter's my stepfather, who was kind of my real father left when I was very young, 6 or 7. And Walter was my stepfather. He passed away about 6 years ago or so. And Walter was a pretty fascinating man. I'm assuming most of you haven't read my book yet. So basically, my real father was a very straight guy. He wore a suit. He had a briefcase. He worked for the Australian government. You know, every night we had dinner at 7. He went on the subway. We lived in New York in his suit. We fished on the weekends. It was very straight. He was a very almost like kind of militant man. He ran a very tight ship. Everything was strict and in line. And we had come from Australia, where I was born, to come to New York for 4 years, where we were going to live while he fulfilled his 4-year engagement at the Australian consulate in New York, and then we were supposed to go back to Australia. However, my wild-ass mom, in all her heart-following inspiration, left my father halfway through, took up with a junky jazz musician who lived in his parents' basement, and off we went. My father went back to Australia by himself, and you know, we moved in with this guy into his parents' basement, and he was a jazz musician.
A bass player.
Yeah. He played the upright bass. And he was an absolutely brilliant musician, very schooled in the most sophisticated way in bebop, the music innovated by Charlie Parker in the 40s. And this is a music that works at such a high level, like intellectually, spiritually, emotionally, every kind of E. You know, it's just a, you know, for me, it's kind of the high point of American culture, along with basketball. Walter also was a violently unpredictable, terrifying man. And he had these really violent episodes that made my childhood very traumatic. And for all of us, he started having these crazy episodes where he'd destroy everything. And, you know, it was a scary. When I was a kid, I was scared to be in the house. It wasn't a safe place to be. And when my mom took up with him, that was kind of the end of us ever being watched. And we were just wild in the street. And I started getting high when I was 11 and getting real crazy. But the thing about Walter, like as difficult as it was, and it took me many, many years to make peace with him and to understand it and to realize that he was a junkie and that he was actually doing way better than the way that he was brought up, like the abuse that he was subject, that he had to deal with when he was a kid. He taught me this thing. I would watch him play bass, and there's a thing in the book that for, you know, it's the first time when I really fell in love with music. And you know, I'd heard music. It was like background stuff in the house before that with my real dad. We heard Peter, Paul, and Mary and, you know, little Dylan or whatever, like, you know, that people have. But it was always quiet. And like when my parents had cocktail parties, the record would come on, you know. But the first time Walter and his buddies sat up in the living room and they started playing some ferocious jazz, and I was a little boy, and it was like, you know, I remember the song, I remember the moment, I remember the color, I remember the way the rug smelled, I remember the smell of weed in the air, not knowing what it was, I remember these jazz guys coming up, I'd never seen anything like it before. They set up their instruments, and, you know, one, two, three, four. They start playing bebop. They start playing Cherokee. And they start playing it fast and violently and revolutionarily because it was a revolutionary music. And I was a little kid, and I heard it, and I jumped down on the floor, and I started rolling around. And I wasn't trying to be silly. I wasn't trying to do a crazy dance. I wasn't trying to do anything. The music took me, and the music took me over, and something flowed through me that was beyond me. It was beyond thought. It was beyond any understanding or anything that I had ever felt or seen before. And I just, you know, remember this so much, and something this repeated many a time. Even my first reaction might have been the most visceral. It was like, you know, when you see someone speaking in tongues at a church meeting or something for real, like being taken over by the Holy Spirit. That's what happened to me as a little boy. And but the thing that I really learned from that was not just that, oh my God, this is magic. And I'm telling you, like, if you got up right now and turned into a gorilla and started, you know, spinning on your head, or, you know, or everyone turned invisible, or it was like Mikhail Bulgakov and everyone turned in, you know, became naked all of a sudden, it wouldn't be more shocking than what I heard that day and when I saw human beings doing this. But the thing, you know, so it opened up this magical thing for me, but the thing that I learned, because when Walter played, he played so hard and so violently, and it was like he was possessed, you know, and I learned what I saw, and I wasn't able to analyze it or intellectualize it as a child, but he was taking all the torment and the torture and the pathos, and he was exercising his demons, and he was turning them into something beautiful. And that was, you know,
The alchemy of art.
That's the alchemy, man. And when I, you know, it's funny because when I started playing, I wanted to be a jazz trumpet player when I was a kid, and I fell in love with the trumpet. Dizzy Gillespie was my hero. But when I started playing rock music, he really, you know, looked down on it. He had a real jazz elitist, you know, rock music is for dumb people. And I was like that when I was a kid. I hated rock music as a kid. I thought it was like, oh, it's for haircuts and silly magazines and dumb outfits, you know. I was totally not into it. Those really dumb outfits, those rock stars were, you know. But I realized, like, as I started playing rock music, he looked down on it, and, you know, and I, at that point I was, you know, a teenager and completely against them anyways, and I, you know, I left home when I was a kid anyways, but I realized, one thing I didn't really realize until after I wrote this book and I was writing about him, everything that I've done, I stole from him. You know, like, that's what I do. Like, of all the, like, the loneliness, the rejection, the pain, the anxiety, the panic that I felt in my life, I take it out on my instrument. Like, when I'm playing, all I'm doing is, like, every note is a prayer, and I want to exercise all the pain that I feel and try to turn it into something beautiful to uplift people.
I found your portrait of Walter very touching.
No,
and I know that he was, you can tell that he was a horror, but you make him into this kind of tragic figure, and I was touched by him.
Well,
jazz musicians tend to be that way anyway.
Yeah, yeah. Well, it was hard. I think a lot of those jazz musicians that grew up loving the great music of the 40s and the 50s, and kind of, like, for him, like, his heyday was kind of in the 60s when he was, like, in his early 20s or whatever. Come the 70s, these guys had like, dedicated themselves to this incredible art form, and no one gave a
shit. Right, there was nothing.
You know, and they saw these guys who they thought could barely play, like, making zillions of dollars, and they were struggling to eat. So it was, you know, it was hard for them. The smart ones, like Miles Davis and, you know, the managed, like, do fusion and incorporate new energy, but it was hard for them.
One of the big surprises in the book was to find out how much your music experience was rooted in jazz.
Yeah.
In the punk world, jazz was really looked down upon. really misunderstood and rejected and
yeah. Well, the crazy thing is like the jazz music, and like I talk about Walter playing, like, look, I was part of the punk rock hardcore scene in California, and it got pretty intense and pretty violent, and cops came and beat everybody with nightsticks, and there were riots, and it was a violent music, and it was like a time, as you know, the great writer Yukio Mishima talks about, art and action coming together, and how rarely that happens. And I feel like in punk rock and the hardcore scene, that actually happened, because it was dangerous, you know. And even I fell in love with that music, but nothing I ever saw at the most violent punk rock show was ever as angst-ridden or as intense as the jazz music that
That's
I heard.
Right, yeah. And I noted with some great pleasure that you guys, some of your early episodes of punk rock were up here in San Francisco.
Oh, absolutely.
Tell us a little. Yeah. Tell them a little about it.
Oh, well, I mean, you know, early on, I played in a band. I started off with my first band in high school, half of which ended up being the Chili Peppers, with Hillel Slovak and Jack Irons and myself. Before that, I played in a punk rock band called Fear that I joined. And I was kind of, you know, I was like 18 years old when I joined Fear, and they were all in their early 30s, and I was like the kid. And they were these like hardcore, rough punk rock guys, you know, just rough and drunk and gnarly and mean and funny and smart and crazy. And anyways, with my very first ever tours, we came up to San Francisco and we played the On Broadway and these places. And I just, you know, I had great, great experiences. There's one story that I tell that I forgot about in my book that's kind of the one time Anthony and I, we came up here and, you know, I feel bad because there's kids in the audience, and my book's not really for kids, you know. even though you guys are here, but I'm not letting my kids read this book. <You know. laughs> But we came up here one night and we shot up this crystal meth in a BART bathroom, and you know, we were feeling pretty wild, and hadn't eaten in a couple of days, and went and saw the Dead Kennedys and Flipper. And, you know, I remember it was just this real wild night, not the healthiest night in the world, and clearly. Then we saw Snake Finger, who was just an absolutely brilliant musician.
His daughter waited on me in a restaurant the other day.
Of his father?
His daughter.
Oh, his daughter.
Yeah, his daughter, not his father, yeah.
Right. Well, I worked in an animal hospital with Gene Vincent's father.
Yes, you did say that. Yeah. So great.
Yeah. But anyways, it was just, you know, the story, we'd go to San Francisco, and then, you know, we don't have any money, and we're coming off drugs, and we'd already been arrested once on the way up because we tried to sneak onto a train and everything, and we get up here, we do the speed, we see the bands, it's crazy, we just kind of walking because we don't know where to go, and we're with this other kid who's walking with us, and he's telling us, you know, he's been living on the street for years, he's a homeless kid, and I remember thinking, like, wow, like, this guy's really homeless. Like, I always have a place to sleep. It's just this night. And it was kind of a crazy feeling, you know? Like, I don't know if you've ever been in experiences, like, maybe you've had times in your life where you're kind of walking on the dangerous side. And I spent a lot of time on a dangerous side. But in this particular instance, this guy kind of assumed that we were homeless also. And I remember thinking, like, man, the line that separates us, and this line has become so much more thin in present day between, like, being on the street starving, like, you know, having nowhere to go and nothing to eat, nothing to do, is it can happen to any of us at any time. And I remember even at that age in my crazy drugged out state, that resonated with me so powerfully. But then we end up walking into this real rich neighborhood. I think it was Knob Hill, and we crawled onto someone's porch. And I remember my mother telling me when I was a kid, if you ever stuck outside, newspaper's a really good insulator. And it was like 4 a.m, and some of their Sunday paper was already there, and I spread out the paper, and me and Anthony, like, cuddled up under this newspaper on the porch and just fall asleep. And then I feel this cop with a nightstick, like, whack, you know, get up. What are you doing on someone's porch? Oh, sorry, officer. You know, and we get up and we leave, and we hitchhiked, we got home, one guy gave us a ride, and he just gave us the car. I noticed about halfway through the ride, there was a screwdriver jammed in the ignition, and He gave us the car. Anyways, that's just a story that I tell. And to be honest, like, this is, like, it's an absurd story, and I do write about it. And, you know, it is a time in my life where I was could have gone any number of ways. And there were quite a few years where I was really risking my life in many ways. But when I wrote the book, like, there were lots of salacious stories or stories that I thought, like, kind of like that. Like, they're wild, and there's drugs, and there's insanity, and, you know, you do drugs, and your rationale goes out the window, you know? But it was really important to me that every word in the book and that every story in the book, I didn't want to write a book full of entertaining stories. And I took a bunch of stories out because I didn't want a laugh, or I didn't want anyone to be like, oh, that's crazy. You know what I mean? It's kind of, well, I mean, there are a few stories in there that I guess are, you know, wild, but I only wrote them because there was something, a time when I learned something important. And I learned, and I had to come to terms with something about myself that I might really love about myself, and also something where I know that I needed to evolve, and I needed to grow, and I needed to become a better person. So I didn't write a book full of crazy tales because I wanted to write about my evolution. Really, the book is about me as a kid, my search for a moral compass, my search to understand, and like later on, you know, it's been 27 years since I stopped doing drugs, and later on when I developed a spiritual practice and I learned about restraint and thoughtfulness and kindness, I realized like all along that was what I wanted. All the drugs, all the being in the street, and I kind of found my family in the street because I didn't have a safe home. So I looked in the street for and my friends that I found, that was those were my chosen family. Those are the people I bonded with. Those are the people I shared my soul with. Those are the people I shared my heart with. And it's no accident that I ended up starting a band with these people, you know, because a band is a sacred thing. And when you have your people and you're playing with your people, for it to work, and if you're actually really going to connect, yeah, the quality of music, and you learn how to maybe really construct a song, and you practice hard to, you know, get your musicianship to the best it can be. But there has to be something more at work for it to really be magic and to really touch people. There has to be a spiritual component. There has to be a communication that goes way beyond just notes or, you know, put a bunch of good musicians together. Like and because, like, we found our family together in the street and in our hijinks and in our friendship and in our yearning for love, that's, you know, why it ended up working.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I could sit here and chat you up all night, but I think, you know, we'd like to, some of the audience would probably have some questions, and I'd like mm-hmm. to hear what they want to ask you, too. But this,
sure.
This is good. Be smart now.
I wanted to ask you about Uplift Mofo Party Plan.
Mm-hmm.
Specifically what you're just talking about, me and my friends, that song was so huge to me. That album is still my favorite Chili Peppers album. I feel like that was the champagne cork of those first three albums.
Mm.
Can you speak a little bit about that album and that time period? And
well, you know, I was about to say no because I really want to talk about the book and not the band. But it's funny enough that you mentioned the only album where the original lineup of the band is. Because we had only ever made a demo tape together, and then all the other records are different incarnations of members besides Anthony and I being the constant. And that, you know, record has Hillel Slovak and has Jack Irons, who, and this is, you know, an example of we loved each other. We knew each other. We didn't need to say things. And all through our band, and from, you know, the day that our band started, like our first show, we had never, ever played together before. We had never, we never spoke about what we were going to play. We had, like, Anthony had seen Grandmaster Flash in the Furious Five and discovered hip-hop and was like, came home to me and was like, Flea, this, I saw the most amazing thing last night. These guys, they tell stories in rhythm, and it's poetry, and it's narrative, and it's unbelievable, and I want to do it. You know, and he sat down, and he wrote this rap, and I came up with a bass line, and I kind of sung some rhythms to Hillel and Jack, and we got together and played. And, you know, we had these other bands that we were real serious about where we tried real hard and we practiced and we wrote. But we got together into this thing that was just kind of like we did it for a friend who needed an opening act, and it was kind of as a joke. But the second we played, it was like the second we did something without thinking about it, and without planning, and without any visible construct of any kind, in 1 second, it was the greatest musical experience of my life, you know? And I felt this organic thing that existed without, you know, having to piece it together to try to please somebody. It just happened by virtue of who we were, and we were just that time in our lives where we could channel that thing, you know? And so, you know, because of our childhood friendship and stuff, and that's the only record that we made with that lineup. And any virtue that it has as a result of that.
This is Bina, KALW's series featuring artists and thinkers who've spoken at the Jewish Community Center of San Francisco. Today's guest is bassist and co-founder of the Red Hot Chili Peppers, Flea, whose new memoir is Acid for the Children. He's joined in conversation by music journalist and author Joel Selvin. Bina is also available as a podcast, and you can find it at kalw.org.
You know, I write one of the principal characters in my book, is Hillel Slovak. And Hillel, you know, was the most beautiful kid I had ever met. He was poetic. He was a real artist. He made these beautiful paintings. I was in love with this kid. I met him, and I'd never met anyone like that. He was tender, and he was sweet, and he was thoughtful, and, you know, and he played the guitar. And, like, you know, Joel spoke a little earlier, just read that one little part about I never liked rock music, and Hillel turned me on to rock music, and I remember, like, you know, I just, you know, the turning on, it's like there are many moments like that, and But I write about this day when I'm lying on his living room floor and he's playing me all these rock records, and his mom was a painter and she loved M.C. Escher, and I'm looking at the thing and I'm hearing the music and I'm thinking, looking at the way, you know, Escher, how it looks, like he does this crazy trick. He has this device where he turns animals into bricks or birds into houses. Anyway, he does these has a certain way, and I saw the way the drawings are moving and the rhythms are moving and everything coming together. And when I started writing about Hillel, I couldn't help. He died very young. He died when he was 26. And he's been dead for so long now. He died in 1988, just a couple of months before my first daughter was born. And he was just a beautiful guy, but I was unable to write about his life without writing about his death. They became these things that were so intertwined. That they as soon as I started writing about him, and I just wanted to write about the excitement of us walking around in high school and talking about music and hearing the records and all this, like this kind of birth for me, and it's opening up this new wave, like, whoa, I'm going to play in a rock band. And he was a guy, you know, but I couldn't help but write about his death as well. But he's also the guy, like when, you know, I just wanted to be a jazz trumpet player, and I started like going over to his house, and he would play with his rock band and in the bedroom and stuff, or in Jack's bedroom, and seeing them play and thinking, like, wow, they, like, I had been studying music academically in school, you know, low-level academic stuff, but learning, like, you know, the rudiments, the fundamentals of music theory and stuff, and I saw they played with no teachers, and they had fun, and they were rocking out, and they had posters of rock bands on the wall, and they're playing, and I was like, wow, this is actually kind of cool, you know, this looks like fun, and I was like, yeah, maybe girls would like me too, and, you know, and I really loved it. And there's this, you know, I'll never forget, it's like another one of these things that's just seared into my memory. This one rainy night, I was sitting in Hillel's car, and you know, we're sitting outside, you know, in his car on this rainy night. We're listening to this DJ we really like. The Doors were playing, Riders on the Storm. We're laid back, and I'm like kind of loving rock music and that kind of poetry and that movement for the first time. Just, and it's like so new, and Jim Morrison was so deep, and it sounded so good. And he was like, Mike, I need to ask you something. I was like, what? He goes, you know, Todd. He had a bass player called Todd. He goes, Todd. He goes, I don't think he believes in it, man. You know, like, it's a hobby for him, and I want you to start playing the bass. And in that moment, I felt so loved, you know, like, so seen, like, and I felt like, you know, he picked me. He wanted me. And it was just so great. And, No, I ran out the next day and got a bass. It was just, I started just like banging on it. And thank you. Anyway, he, you know, and that changed my life and sent me on this new path. And I got that feeling of like the family of being in a band. And, you know, we closed everyone else out and we were inside. And it was this magic place. And we just got in the room and we played and we played. And we didn't talk. We just played, you know. And you know, and I found my voice in a way that was really healthy for me.
You know, there's so much pain and suffering, and we all, you know, use drugs and do things and drink. How would you say today to find your way to kind of, like, steer into the skid? Because you found your way out. A lot of people don't. A lot of us are still there. And really, like, how can you find your way? Could you give us a little bit about that?
Yeah. You know, I started getting high when I was 11. And when I was about 15, I started shooting up. I did every drug in the book until I was about 30 when I stopped. I'm 57 now. For me, you know, luckily, believe it or not, like through all my absurd and ridiculous behavior as a drug abuser, I never got strung out. Like I was never a junkie. I always sort of had this something inside of me that wanted to do things that were really important that stopped me from getting strung out or really becoming a drug addict. I skirted the line. I hurt myself immeasurably. It took me many years to recover. It was terrible. But I never got strung out. And maybe I just don't have that addictive gene, you know? So, and I have many, many friends, you know, very close friends who died. You know, I have, you know, many of my closest friends who struggled forever with drugs. And I know for myself that when I stopped doing drugs, I wanted to feel everything. I wanted to feel my pain. And I, like, all my life I've suffered from really bad anxiety attacks and panic attacks and periods of, like, immense insecurity and have a really hard time just loving myself for just being me. And, you know, it's a work in progress. But when I stopped doing drugs, I wanted to feel everything. I wanted to feel all the pain, all the suffering, all the anxiety, because I knew that the only way that I was going to grow was to feel it. And I know that we all yearn to be as deep as we can be, to be as kind and compassionate and as good as we can be. And the only way to be that is to feel your pain and to sit there and let it wash over you. And like now, you know, I'm not a religious man. I'm not. And when I'm hurting, but I believe in God and I pray. And when I'm hurting and I feel terrible, I get on my knees and I say, "Dear God, give me some more. You know, thank you. You know, I know nothing. Thank you. You know, help me." And I know that within my suffering, I will grow. You know, and I never thought, like, in doing my drugs, I never thought I was trying to get rid of pain. I always thought I was, like, this great explorer. You know what I mean? I was, like, I had one up on the squares. I was, like, I saw the world as this hypocritical, cruel, mean place. You know, I didn't like rich people. I didn't like these people. I didn't trust anyone. And I thought, like, I'm doing drugs. And it was like, woohoo! You know, I'm, like, I'm in this rarefied air now, you know? But it's really like, it's just an old and pathetic story. And the opportunity to be straight and to actually connect with people in true ways and to be willing to feel lonely and to be patient enough to have like a real actual honest communication, whether it means like going to get a taco and looking at the woman who gives it to you and smiling at her and her smiling back and you actually sharing a beautiful moment. Like those are the little triumphs that for me make not being on drugs the greatest thing.
Hi, Flea. My name is Sabina. Thank you so much for being here. You're awesome, and we all love you.
Thank you.
Woo! I have a question. So in the process of writing the book, did you find something new about yourself that you didn't know before, or did you discover anything new about yourself?
I found so much about myself that I didn't know before. Especially because when I started writing, I wrote from a place of feeling, I didn't, when I started like with any kind of story, it was something that I knew was when I, like the world kind of turned on its axis and something opened up in me, and everything that I wrote about had to do with something like that. And every time, but the whole point of writing the book for me was to find things out about myself that I didn't know. So I'd start with this feeling, start with a story that I knew was important, but I might not even know why or remember the story exactly. But once I started writing, this murky, foggy thing would become clear. And then I would feel, because I came from a place of feeling, it wasn't just because it was a good story. It was because something that had really moved me and changed me. And there's this one thing that I write, this one line in the book that I write, and for me, it's the most, in terms of like learning in the book, it's kind of the most important line. And I don't know, everyone else might kind of just read it and read through it, and it's a cool little part of the book, but there's, but I write this story about the French poet Arthur Rimbaud, who was, a great poet. He wrote all his stuff as a really young man. He was a wild character. Then he went off and lived in Africa, in a Ethiopia, and was like running guns, anyways. But he was really into being wild and shocking. And there's this one story where he's in this French cafe, and you know this story. He's in this like sophisticated French cafe, and he gets up on a table in the middle of the restaurant, takes a on the table in front of all these like sophisticated people, and it's disgusting and shocking, but he was so like wanted to freak out the squares and wanted to get wild. He just like, and I was like that for so long. I was so in my yearning to like, I was like, come on, let's do something, like at shows I was playing or I was at a party or anything, I'd pull down my pants because I thought it was wild, or I'd say something offensive and weird. I'd do anything crazy just to like, I don't know, because it was like what do you do, make small talk? You know what I mean? I was always just trying to freak out the scene, but it was my yearning, the reason I was doing it, and this is something I learned about myself when I was writing a book, was that in my yearning to mix it up and to get to a place like when I was playing music and I was totally beyond thought, and I loved basketball. I played basketball every day. And because in that motion and in that lost in the game, I got beyond thought. It's this telepathic game. Everything I did where I didn't think I would be happy. And it was because, I was yearning for this like a spiritual state. That's what being enlightened is. It's beyond thought. But the thing, my favorite line in the book is the point I write better than I talk, folks. But I say I had always yearned to get beyond thought. But it wasn't until much later that I learned getting beyond thought didn't mean being thoughtless. And for me, that was a real big me coming to terms with something about myself. Because, sometimes it was crazy. I started new conversations, it got wild, it was good, and it was healthy. But oftentimes, I was an offensive, rude asshole. I hurt people's feelings. I was an idiot. I was obnoxious. And in that yearning, that was a big, it was a big thing for me. Anyways, that's that.
Hi, Flea. My name's Acacia. You're about the age, you're older than my parents and stuff. And they are cool, but they're also not very positive. I just don't see a lot of people that are your age that are just so damn positive. And I want to be like that, and I don't know how you do, and I just am wondering how you do that.
I think, whatever positivity I'm able to, channel, and I'm just grateful to be alive, there's so many things that I love, literature. I got to write a book, it's my lifelong dream. There's so many things that I want to do. It's just beautiful things, art, literature, film, human beings that I love. Like, I'm just fascinated, and like I said earlier to the woman up here who asked about drugs, in feeling my pain and in feeling my stuff and everything that was ever hard for me. And look, my life compared to many is a cakewalk. And, you know, people have way more difficult lives than me. But the depth of pain and anxiety that I have felt in my life, in those times, I knew that if I sat through it consciously, and I felt it consciously, and I was grateful for it consciously, that I would be a deeper, kinder, happier person. So my great advice is to never run away from anything. No matter how much you get betrayed, the world is unjust, feel it all and be the most righteous person you can be. And don't hold bitterness, forgive people. And I say forgive, I don't mean not having boundaries, not being, you know, standing up for yourself. But the power of forgiveness is a powerful thing. Because if you don't forgive someone for something that happened, all your energy is back at that other place. You're walking through life with half your energy, you know? Forgive people. Own yourself. And positivity will be an organic and natural thing. And, you know, when I remember being a kid and I used to work at this liquor store doing liquor delivery. And, you know, I was, I don't know, 16, 17, something like that. Worked full-time in this liquor store. And there's this lady that used to come in sometimes to buy stuff. She was an elderly woman. And she was the most beautiful woman I ever saw. I to this day, except for my wife, of course. But she must have been 80 years old. And I looked in her eyes and I saw this like glowing thing, like these beautiful eyes. And her face was so, you know, she was wrinkled and old and stuff, but the beauty was just like unparalleled. And it was because I knew that she just didn't have a bitter atom in her body. She didn't have a resentful atom in her body. And people suffer all kinds of injustices. But you see people that even that have suffered like beyond the pale of what we could ever understand, but they feel it and they still love and they forgive. And that's, you know, that's everything to me. And like when I was a kid and I saw that woman, I was like, you know, I don't know how, but that's what I want, you know. And then it took me a long time to learn how, but I did.
All right. Thank you very much. Lee?
All right, thanks, man.
Yeah, man. You wrote a great book.
Thank you.
Thank you very much.
One of my favorite musicians ever is this guy, Mike Watt. And I toured with him, and I'm going to quote him right now, because at the end of every show, he always says, sing your own song, write your own book, act in your own movie, make your own art, paint your own painting, sing your song, do it. Don't let it die dormant, do it. Thank you. Good night. Thank you.
Bina is a co-production of the Jewish Community Center of San Francisco and KALW. For more information about programs at the JCCSF, you can visit jccsf.org. Today's guest was bassist and co-founder of the Red Hot Chili Peppers, Flea, whose new memoir is Acid for the Children. He was joined in conversation by music journalist and author Joel Selvin. The recording engineers at the JCCSF are Ben Bernardi, Alex Espelay, Dan Folds, Carly Mari, and Aiden Nelson. David Kwan edits and produces the program, and Tina Pimentuan is the executive producer. Our theme music is from the album Masada Rock by the Rashanim Trio, and the music you're hearing right now is by John Zorn. Bina is available as a podcast, and you can find it at kalw.org. I'm Jordan Abel. Thanks for listening.